drive a Chevy, 'cause he drove Chevys. Like him, I'm a baseball fan. I'm going back to see him while he still knows who I am.
Welcome.
Mama says
this is Dr. Steve Nurse. And this is our next series of Is Abled, and it's a series on dementia and Alzheimer's. And what we would like to do here is let you know what you need to know about dementia and Alzheimer's disease. The series is 6 episodes, and we will discuss both dementia and Alzheimer's disease. The main person interviewed is Brad Tyson. Dr. Brad Tyson has been a clinical neuropsychologist since 2014 and specializes in cognitive assessment. He has clinical and research interests in dementia, traumatic brain injury, Parkinson's disease, multiple sclerosis, epilepsy, substance abuse, chronic pain, and general medical disorders associated with cognitive impairment. He was trained in neuropsychology and neuroimaging research at Dartmouth Medical Center in New Hampshire. He currently works for the Eastside Neuroscience Institute at Evergreen and Overlake Medical Centers. Hello, this is Dr. Steve Nurse, and this is our first episode in the series on dementia and Alzheimer's. And I think I need to give you a little background in why we just even got interested in this. One was, if you look at the population of Vashon, the average age is 52. So we have a much older than average age out here than many places do. And of course, with age comes disability, all types. And one of those disabilities is dementia and Alzheimer's. And so it's also an area where there is a tremendous amount of myth and what's going to work to improve your memory. We hear things about Prevagen, things that are going to, you know, magically make you better. And that doesn't happen. So we'd like to go through with Dr. Tyson just describing dementia and Alzheimer's and talking different types, what's the difference between the two, and go from there. So Brad's here with us in the, I guess I can call you Brad, can I?
Sure.
Or Dr. Tyson. Not the Tyson of chicken fame.
I wish.
Yeah, he wish. If he was, he would be making millions on chicken nuggets instead of doing the, we are paying him for this, a cup of coffee. So here we go. Brad, kind of tell me what you do on an average day when you're at Evergreen and working with patients.
Yeah, so thanks, Steve, for having me. So as your intro said, I'm a neuropsychologist at the Evergreen Medical Center in Kirkland, part of the Eastside Neuroscience Institute, along with Overlake Medical Center in Bellevue. We provide neurological services to the east side of Lake Washington. We have a Parkinson's disease center, multiple sclerosis center, an epilepsy center, stroke service, neurosurgery, and clinical neuropsychology.
And you were saying you do a podcast or a Zoom a Zoomcast with a group of people that are kind of a support group for Parkinson's?
Yeah, I run a support group for men with Parkinson's.
Men.
It's once a month. It's online. So anybody can participate if they have Parkinson's or if they're on the Parkinson's spectrum, which we can talk a little bit about.
Right. Okay, that sounds good. And so, and you and I have talked about this a lot, and I'm interested in it, and you know, getting to be an old guy myself. Why don't you talk a little bit about dementia and Alzheimer's and the difference kind of between them? I think probably one's broader than the other, but...
Yeah, they're the same thing. And we can talk about that, and there's really not a difference. I mean, as I'll talk about, dementia is an umbrella term of which there's many different kinds.
Right.
So I would use a metaphor of heart disease. So heart disease is kind of an umbrella term.
Right.
There's congestive heart failure, there's atrial fibrillation, there's myocardial infarction. So there's lots of different kinds of heart disease.
So almost even like learning disabilities, lots of different kinds of learning disabilities.
Exactly, yeah. So dementia is an all-encompassing term of which there's many different kinds. So Alzheimer's is the most common form of dementia. But I'll start by talking about what a clinical neuropsychologist is and what they do. What we do is we evaluate cognition, emotion, and behavior as it relates to brain functioning and disease states. And my specialty at this point in my career, anyway, is probably dementia. And on a typical day, I would do a neuropsychological evaluation. So that involves medical record review, clinical interview with patients and family members, behavioral observations, and psychometric testing, primarily cognitive assessment. A neuropsychological report provides a summary of cognitive strengths and weaknesses, emotional factors, and overall behavioral functioning. Relevant diagnoses, you know, for instance, presence and type of dementia, and recommendations to help treat, manage, and further evaluate potential cognitive, emotional, behavioral problems.
Yeah. When you look at history, is there, if you, you know, I know like with certain kinds of cancers, you look at a person's history and you say, oh, you know, your aunt had this kind of cancer or something, and so this is something we should watch out for you. Is dementia the same way? Does it fall in a, for families and that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, there is often a family history of dementia, but not always. And there are, you know, causative genes and risk genes, and we can spend a little more time talking about that.
Sure.
When we talk about the specific forms of dementia. You know, I'll go back to sort of what the purposes of, and the reason I exist, and the purposes of a neuropsychological evaluation. Primarily detection of cognitive impairment. So does this person have cognitive impairment, and what are the potential causes? Also identification of factors potentially impacting cognition. Particularly, I want to find out if the person has treatable or reversible factors of cognitive decline, something like a medication that they're taking, or untreated sleep apnea, or nutritional deficiencies. Assistance in diagnosis and or differential diagnosis. That's a, doctors will refer patients to me, and you know, they want to know, is this dementia, and what type of dementia is it?
And that's interesting, because what you're saying, what I hear you saying, is that there, you know, that there are so many factors to this, to making a diagnosis, that, and I know with other conditions too. If you get too much of a medication or not enough, or,
sure,
you know, that can certainly affect other parts of the body. And so,
yeah. And the only way to really definitively diagnose dementia is with autopsy, which, you know, isn't usually practical.
Yeah, that's right.
Most people that come to my office.
And
brain biopsy, but I mean, nobody ever does
that. Yeah. And I've actually heard that before, so... And what, and then they can really tell that there is that there's a lot of scarring in the brain, or the
So, you know,
plaque.
when you have, you know, a neurological workup, when you've ruled out, you know, other factors that could be contributory, when you have brain imaging and there's, you know, an increasing number of biomarkers, and you have neuropsychological testing, if you put all these factors together, diagnostic accuracy in a living person is 90 to 95%. So, I mean, you can still diagnose this. It's complex, and there's a lot of factors involved, as you mentioned. But, you know, the only definitive way to have the diagnosis established is with you know, pathological studies.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, because you see, I think there's so much bad information out there. One of the things I did in kind of preparing for this, I Googled it and
Googled what?
Yeah, you know, and you get up things like on, you know, that pop up.
You Googled the term dementia?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And you get a million things,
sure.
And you get a lot of stuff on YouTube. A lot of advertisements on things that are going to make you okay.
Yeah.
You know, something that came from a jellyfish or...
can talk about Prevagen, which you mentioned and which I would, advise against.
But one of the things that a lot of times they'll do is they'll say, we have a test. Answer these 10 questions and we can tell you if you have dementia. And, that you know, you can't do that kind of a...
You know who fails those tests the most? People with depression.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, you know, which failing one of those tests is not very good for your mood.
Yeah. And you can't also say, I would think, I couldn't find my car keys this morning, you know.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that I,
Right.
That doesn't mean that I have dementia.
Yeah. Well, I mean, something interesting that I would add to that is that, certain cognitive abilities decline naturally with age.
Right.
So, things like, how quickly we process information, how quickly we find words, how quickly we learn something, short-term memory, that these things, sadly, peak between 20 and 40 years old in everybody and start declining in everybody in, your 50s. And so, most of the people I see are 60 or older. And so if you have short-term memory loss in your 60s or 70s, yes, you do. I mean, your memory's not as sharp as it once was. But so what we really need to know is if that is more than just age-related. And that's what a neuropsychological evaluation can help us do.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of back to the purposes of a neuropsychological evaluation. So sometimes a doctor might refer someone to me and want to know, is this person's problems more characteristic of a neurological disorder or a psychiatric disorder?
Or it might be depression, maybe, even something like that.
Very, very common cause. So common, it's called pseudo-dementia. So you see a lot of people who are depressed and view things pessimistically, including their cognitive performance, or maybe they don't want to seek attention, medical attention for depression, so they focus on the cognitive problems and what we can sort of do to treat the cognitive problems.
Do we know if males or females have more dementia? Is it
females have a higher rate of dementia? It's not entirely clear why that is. And it's not just because they live a little bit longer than men.
Interesting.
Yeah. Another primary purpose of a neuropsychological evaluation is tracking potential cognitive change over time. So like examples of that might be evaluations of the effects of a treatment, such as a medication or cognitive rehabilitation, monitoring the potential progression of a mild neurocognitive disorder or a dementia over time. And this is very important, of course, in staging dementia and mild, moderate, severe, and the prodromal phase of dementia, which is called mild neurocognitive disorder. And all of this guides interdisciplinary treatment planning and rehabilitation. Sometimes we're asked to comment on decision-making capacity for social services or legal purposes, like, can this person drive? Can they work? Can they live independently, make medical decisions, or just, make decisions in their own best interests, enter into a contract, change their will, that sort of thing. And there are forensic applications of neuropsychological evaluations. These are quite common in personal injury actions in which monetary compensation is sought for claims of bodily injury and loss of function. And so I do some of these types of evaluations in my private practice in Everett, which typically revolves around questions such as whether a person experienced cognitive problems as the result of a head injury or some other accident. They got in a motor vehicle accident, and now they're involved in a court case because they're claiming that they have memory impairment.
So with a traumatic TBI or... traumatic mm-hmm. brain injury,
mm-hmm.
that may also kind of be misdiagnosed as dementia or...
Well,
it might even affect it, I guess.
Yeah,
right.
I mean, so you can certainly have dementia due to traumatic brain injury. You know, so you can have repeated, you know, mild traumatic brain injury, which you see like in football players and boxers. This is called chronic traumatic encephalopathy. Or you could have a severe traumatic brain injury, and that could be sufficient enough to affect your ability to live independently, which is one of the criteria for dementia. And many neuropsychologists also do research. And, you know, so more and more, you know, cognitive assessment is used in certain drug trials, often with results that drug companies don't like.
You know? Yes, yeah. And drugs can be very expensive, too, that's for sure.
Yeah. And so let me just tell you what dementia is. And we talked about dementia as kind of like this umbrella term. You know, there's many different kinds of dementia. And as I alluded to earlier, I'll start by talking about, I guess, you know, the diagnosis of dementia and what constitutes dementia. And there are two main criteria. One, cognitive decline that is more than just age-related. And, you know, as I talked about, you know, there's several different, you know, aspects of cognition that decline naturally with age. And neuropsychological evaluation can help determine whether this is something that is more than age-related. So the first criteria is cognitive decline that's more than age-related. And the second criteria revolves around performance of complex activities of daily living. So that cognitive decline needs to be significant enough to impact somebody's ability to live independently. Okay, so like driving or coordinating transportation, people stop driving for a variety of reasons, but can you, let's say, get to your doctor's appointment, right? Can you schedule your doctor's appointment and remember to be there on time and then coordinate the transportation to get there, whether you're driving or using the bus or having someone else take you or these days using an Uber, taking your medications as prescribed. And, you know, really in my experience, the issue with medications is not forgetting to take a medication, which if you miss a medication every once in a while, it's probably okay. But the bigger issue is forgetting if you took it earlier that day and then taking it again later that day, and then maybe taking it again later that day because you couldn't remember if you took it earlier.
Right.
So that can lead to overdose sometimes. Sometimes we see that.
I remember my mother, when she was close to 95, she loved these little caramel candies, these little caramel nips, and she loved fudgesicles. Yeah. And, you know, I would go to the store and get a bag of 50 fudgesicles and put them in her. Uh-huh. And she loved them, but she forgot that she already had eaten four fudgesicles that day. So I would see her chair by the TV, you know, and here would be this pile of fudgesicle sticks, you know, that had been gone in 4 days. And I guess at 95 you can do that. But how about leaving something like, you know, I've left the stove on myself.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But if you do that kind of chronically, that would be more of an indication.
Yeah, and really what we're talking about is safety issues. So if you forget where your keys are or, you know, you leave the stove on once or twice, that's probably okay, depending on the circumstances. But we're really talking about these sort of chronic issues. Is the person safe, right? And, you know, some of these complex activities of daily living also include things like managing finances appropriately. Can you pay the bills on time, not get the power shut off? Preparing meals, you know, not leaving the stove on chronically, like you said. Grocery shopping, completing necessary household tasks. You know, doing everything that you need to do to be able to live independently.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I also think you hear a lot about people that are working with people or helping people that have memory care issues and really taking advantage of them because they don't know all those, you know, they don't know how to take bills and, you know, take care of stuff.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah. And so that's one of the things I, you know, I ask everybody, right? I ask, you know, the patient that I'm seeing, do you think you could live independently? But I also need to ask the family members. Because, you know, I think the most concerning situation when people come to my office is if the patient comes in, let's say with their spouse, and the patient says, you know, I don't really think I have, you know, any cognitive problems. I think, you know, maybe I have some memory loss, but it's probably age related, right? But then the family member says, no, I mean, he has tremendous memory loss. He's not aware of it. And he's unable to, you know, live independently without my assistance. And he doesn't recognize it. That's almost always dementia. Almost always. And usually Alzheimer's disease.
Yeah. So and I would imagine there's a certain amount of denial. I mean,
Yeah, maybe.
Or you don't know you're denying it? Or?
Well, so that's just it, right? You don't remember what you don't remember. So your memory fails to update the fact that you're forgetting things, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, yeah.
And I wouldn't say it's psychological denial. It's something called anosognosia, okay? And breaking that term down, it means without disease knowledge. And so there's impaired awareness, and it's not just a psychological defense mechanism or something.
Mm-hmm.
It's a physiological process of the brain. And it happens in schizophrenia, for example. People don't think they have schizophrenia. They won't take their medications, right? And it happens in dementia.
Do you think that because our population is getting older, you know, I hear ads on the radio all the time for memory care.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm assuming that's probably some type of dementia or some type of Alzheimer's.
Well, the memory care just refers to an advanced level of care for someone in assisted living.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of great sort of senior living communities and assisted living communities where you can move into one of these places well before you have significant cognitive decline. And then you can add services as you need them. So if you need somebody to come by to your, you know, to your room and dispense medications, then
Right. Somebody
can do that, or they prepare the meals for you. And then sort of as you advance and you really need, you know, more, you know, consistent care, 24-hour care, that would be memory care.
And I would think doing the medications would be really critical. I mean, that's a...
Because, of course, you know, when people get older, right, dementia is one thing, but they often accumulate a lot of other medical issues, and their medications increase, and their regimen becomes more complex.
Is there a percentage of people that tend to get dementia, one of the things I've heard with prostate cancer, my doctor told me this. He said many times you don't die from prostate cancer, but many times you die with prostate cancer.
Yeah. I've heard that said about Parkinson's disease, and to some extent that's true.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Is it a large percentage of people that get dementia when they...
Extremely. Shockingly high. Yeah. I mean, so the most significant risk factor for dementia of any kind is age. So the older you get, the more likely you'll get it. So as it stands now, about 50% of people 85 or older have dementia.
So
it's a striking number. That will change by the time, you know, we're 85. But, we're having, you know, better, you know, dementia therapeutics come out all the time. They're still not there yet. But, it's a staggering number.
Right. And talk about, again, we've got a few minutes for this first segment. Different types of dementia. You mentioned chronic, and does dementia go faster in some people than in others?
Yeah, absolutely. So it really depends on the type of dementia. Maybe we can get into that into the second episode, because that will take a lot more time, I think. There are forms of early onset dementia that can strike. I mean, the youngest person I've ever seen with dementia was 41, this person had Alzheimer's disease. Depending on the type of dementia, it can progress very quickly. There are certain forms of Parkinsonism that progress very quickly. Alzheimer's disease progresses quite slowly. It's a very gradual onset and progression. And sadly, you know, and this is probably speaks to a bigger issue with medical care in general, is that we don't typically see people until they have symptoms. And by the time they have symptoms, sufficient enough to come come to my office, which means you've seen a primary care doc, you've seen a neurologist, and now you're to the third person at least to evaluate this thing. There's not a whole lot we can do.
So
we really, really want to focus on prevention.
So one of the things that, for instance, we go in and have colonoscopies every 5 years once we get to be 50 or something. Yeah. And that's kind of a preventative type of thing, or it's to catch the cancer early. Do we have something like that we can use?
We have lots of things like that. So probably the most significant thing is exercise, and particularly aerobic exercise is one of the best things that we know of that's preventative to some degree, and can also, in some forms of dementia, really help treat the disease. It may be the only thing that we know of at this point that can subtly reduce symptoms of Parkinson's disease, for example.
Wow.
Next to that, I would say, learning and staying mentally active. The more education you have, the more knowledge you have in your brain, the more resilient your brain is to cognitive decline. Wow. Later in life.
Well, I'm getting fascinated with this, and I let's call it for our first episode. And we'll be back for episode 2 and learn more about the different types of dementia and go from there.
I look forward to it.
Thanks, Brad.
I drive a Chevy 'cause he drove Chevys. Like him, I'm a baseball fan. I'm going back to see him while he still knows who I am.
This is Dr. Mama Steve Nurse, and I want to thank everybody for listening to our series on dementia and Alzheimer's disease on Voice of Vashon, the Dynamo of Washington. Thank you, everyone. Have a great day.
While he still knows who I am. This time I instead of just shaking hands, gonna tell him that I love him while he still knows.